Blog Talk Radio.
Tonight is April the 7th, 2020, Tuesday. And our call-in number is 347-857-3293. And this is Ralph Pointer, What's Happening, Blog Talk Radio. And if it's not April Fool's Day, well, it should be, or can you believe this? Trump's continued program for war on illicit drugs in the midst of a pandemic? And to address some of the issues that are happening during this genocidal crisis, for those of us who are oppressed, who are poor, who are working class, who are not privileged, who are not rich, we have a specialist, Sister Mary Adams. She is an RN with a master's in the public health field, and she will be giving us some of her insights tonight on the COVID-19 update. And hopefully Sister Belinda in New Orleans will be calling back if she can, because as you know, New Orleans is top the charts in terms of a COVID-19 genocide statistics. So in addition to that, we're hoping that we'll have some special guests calling in from New Jersey. We're hoping that there people will be calling in with some statistics from all over the country. Tom has some very interesting information to share with us. So we'll get this started, and we will introduce Ralph Pointer. What's happening?
Good evening, my brothers and sisters. April 7th. Now, as a reminder on this program to educate and to free political prisoners, it is what I believe. The overriding element in every situation or circumstance in a black life is racism. Birth, elementary school, housing, health, food, etc. Black lives have never mattered except during slavery and other circumstances where money is being made by our labors for others. The modern death penalty, 80% black, move lynching indoors. The police, as the army of occupation, have taken lynching outside again. The lynch mob is a racist system, including the courts and the media. And because the lives of our heroes and sheroes who once protected us in our community do not matter to us, the people, our political prisoners are now dying in captivity. They are tortured and isolated. Only armed struggle can recreate our image in our own minds as well as the minds of others. Wake up. Now is the time. We must participate in the struggle by freeing our political prisoners. Now, to our discussions for this evening. Was it April Fool's Day, or can you believe this? Trump's continued program for a war on illicit drugs. Well, that is really something. War on illicit drugs in the middle of the COVID-19 epidemic, coronavirus, when people are dying, and the only weapon against the coronavirus is separation, and Trump is calling for the gathering on ships by the Coast Guard and the Navy to patrol for illicit drugs. Remember, kind of a repeat of the attack on Panama. What was the excuse? Drugs. It caused a pandemic in the banking system, which lets you know that the banks were involved in drug money, laundering money, etc. It was a pandemic until the U.S. government under Bush said, no, not you, meaning they had a pass for their illicit money laundering, drug dealing, using, cleaning of drug money, etc. Only those other guys were to be punished for drug trade. And when we talk about, was it April Fool's Day or just another day in the life of a country run by Trump? We see Trump removes the inspector general who was to oversee $2 trillion in stimulus spending. I'm getting tongue-tied because this is so enormous. But recently, it has gone to $4 trillion, and it's been estimated as high as $7 trillion, and Trump removes the inspector general who was to oversee that, meaning they don't want oversight. They just want to spend the money like they did in 2008, like they did recently. And it goes, the beat goes on. And there's confusion surrounding the truth-telling by a Navy ship commander, Captain Brett Crozier, who docked an aircraft carrier in Guam for 14 days to achieve social distancing. You got to read up on that. Very interesting. And then Trump again denies seeing warning memos by Peter Navarro, his trade advisor, who warned in January that the COVID-19 could kill 500,000 Americans and cost close to $6 trillion. Here we are facing the reality that the powerless in every society will be the most severely punished by natural and unnatural disasters. Natural disasters like hurricanes and unnatural disasters like the embargo on medicine and other goods for trades between nations. And remember the prelude to the invasion of Panama? And as I said before, we have to support the people of Venezuela, because this could be a prelude to war when Trump talks about, or the American talks about, the illicit drug trade. And we're going to have to spend time talking about that. And now a moment of praise and constant memory of the recognition of the Cuban people and the Cuban Revolution for their part in past and present actions in making the world a better place. Presently in Italy, 80 doctors, nurses, etc., health workers going to Italy. Doctors and health workers going to Haiti. Doctors being educated in Cuba to serve in underserved communities in America. And so, memories of the Cuban Revolution yesterday in Africa, today in Italy, Haiti, and the U.S., tomorrow in the world. Let's work to end the embargo against Cuba and other communities struggling for freedom. And so, Sister Betty, let us continue the program.
Thank you so much, Brother Ralph. And again, we apologize for stumbling and stammering today, but we have been receiving, as I'm sure some of you have, some upsetting and disturbing news. So as usual, in honor of Sister Lynn, our first guest panelist is always dealing with liberation poetry. Professor Louis, your mic is open. It is so good to see you on the screen.
All right. Some got a lot and some got a little. Is there anybody left in the middle? Blame your brain till you solve the riddle. Why do some got a lot and some got a little? Anything worth anything comes from work. The earth grows food, but someone dug the dirt. Someone plants the seed you need to make it grow. Someone worked a row with a shovel and hoe. You build homes, roads, you teach kids. You won't get rich from the work you did, because just three people in the USA own more than 160 million other people today. The 160 million could work day and night with all their might, but they will never see the sight of billions. Instead, they got a fight with millions of headaches, heartaches, bad breaks, and cornflakes. And the richest keep getting more. And who opened the door for the space between rich and poor that keeps getting more for the last 40 years? When the smoke clears, who had no choice and who had the Rolls Royce? And just 1% at the top, in case you forgot, hold half the money. We all get what's left. That's kind of crummy and not too funny. And it's true, if you knew you didn't think it through, the 99%, that's me and you. And with big money comes big power. Every hour when you shower money on politicians, sure enough, they huff and puff, but they go with the money when stuff gets rough. And the politician don't need a special message sent, because he himself is the 1%. And money in government makes the laws that cause the open doors for some to be on top and some to be forgot. Because a lot of rich people are born that way. No matter what they say, they don't work for their pay. Some born with billions, living with ease. Some born with diddly squat, living with fleas. It's cold. Some got millions at 3 years old, and we're told we're all equal. But we don't start that way, and don't ignore that the law lets it all stay and pay money to the next generation and spoil rotten rich kids' common rotation. They run the nation, and corporations and billionaires snort cocaine while you clean the drain. They put money overseas like a disease nobody sees. It slips through the cracks. They don't send no facts and don't pay no tax. And who made the law and who didn't snitch is a sure enough bitch. you could go bankrupt and stay filthy rich. And we pay for the roads corporations use. We pay for the airports their airplanes choose. It gives you the blues, and it's not news. But we pay the bailout when corporations lose. We pay to clean up all their pollution. There's no solution to the pollution that surrounds us, all around us. But when it gets you sick, you find real quick. When the doc gets paid, it's us who are made to blow the dough and not too slow, else you go coughing down the block. And the company that made you cough sells more stock, and most stock in the USA, by the way, is owned by 1/10 of the people today. And if they buy and sell stock, they could clock millions in an hour. It's a really weird power, because buying and selling don't do nothing for no one. It's not fun. It don't shine in the sun. But buying and selling does nothing for no one. And we once found out we could do without queens and kings. Now corporations and billionaires, do we need these things? Check out this question appropriately. What have they done for you lately? So the system was already set with what we're going to get right from the jump. Are you a chump or are you a Trump? Are you rolling in dough or a regular Joe? And no muss, no fuss. The super, super rich do not like us. Throw you under the bus, Gus, and they do not pause to make all the laws, all the rules, to make us the fools. And it's in the air, if you really dare, to really care about what's really fair. The world don't need even one billionaire, because some get a lot and some get a little. Is there anyone left in the middle? Blame your brain till you solve the riddle. Why do some get a lot and some get a little?
Well, thank you again, Professor Louis. That reminds us all there are 90% of me and you, and those other guys are really getting away with murder, and we are going to have to organize to do something about it. Thank you again, Professor Louis. Sister Betty.
Now we're going to give you your COVID-19 update. We're going to call on a real advocate for human rights and political prisoners, Sister Mary Adams. She's also an advocate for community control of schools, and she is a public health informative expert. So without further ado, because we do have a lot of guests on the call tonight, Sister Mary Adams, your mic is open, and thank you so much for coming on such short notice.
Thank you for inviting me. Is my sound working?
It is working.
Can you hear me? Okay, great.
We clear.
Thank you for inviting me, and I really appreciated that those words, Professor Louis, because I mean we're seeing things that seem impossible. The money that's been mobilized, the commerce and ventilators that's going on, the profiteering, you know, in the midst of this public health crisis, and yet the austerity hammer is as hard as ever on our public schools and in our healthcare system. Medicaid cuts are still going through. So thank you for that. And this is really the context that we're living in. But I really wanted to share just some kind of basic information, because the people who I love, the revolutionary leaders, my elders that I see, friends, people in my community, there's so much confusion around this virus and how to protect ourselves and each other. I'm seeing people who, you know, genius community leaders who are either reckless and not taking this seriously and really acting in ways that are cavalier that can really hurt themselves and others. And then on the other extreme, I'm seeing people like immobilized by panic and fear and really, you know, really immobilized and not being able to carry on their life. So I wanted to share some basic information, the kind of information that I've been almost nonstop talking with different people about. So this disease, COVID-19, is caused by SARS-CoV-2, which is a new virus that humans have not seen. So our amazing complex immune systems don't have in our repertoire the ability to combat this brand new virus to humans. So that's why it's so dangerous and so why we are so susceptible to it. And I certainly don't need to share the seriousness of the gravity to folks who are in New York City. So I'm calling from Rochester. where we also have an epidemic, and we have, you know, serious numbers in our intensive care unit and numbers of death, but nowhere near the crisis that's going on in New York City. So a couple of things. I told Sister Betty that I would speak about this controversy around masks, like whether to wear masks in public. There was recent guidance from CDC and the New York State Department of Health. Our local county health departments are telling us to basically wear a face covering in public at all times now. And that's new guidance. And it's different from the World Health Organization, which still is suggesting, or their guidance is that masks are not necessarily in public as a rule, but should be worn by a sick person or by those caring for, and for those caring for a sick person. So I'm talking strictly now about public use. I'm not talking about healthcare settings now. So this new guidance is a little bit controversial, and basically it should be understood that the purpose of general mask wearing in public is to prevent a person from potentially spreading droplets that could then either in close contact with another person be inhaled, like land basically on the nose. Not necessarily, it's not aerosolized, it's not airborne like we think of measles or chickenpox being airborne. It's not an airborne virus, but the respiratory droplets can be in the air and small particles can drop near a nose, near an eye, near a mouth, and that can cause infection. But the much more frequent way of transmitting is when droplets fall onto a surface and a person touches those droplets and then touches their face. And so I'm sure, you know, you've probably been inundated with the guidance, wash your hands, don't touch your face, don't touch your face. That's the reason. So the reason for masks in public is to cut down on those respiratory droplets that might spread into the nearby air and surfaces and land on surfaces and then be efficiently transmitting the virus. So what it does not do is there's no evidence to think that wearing a mask will protect you. A regular, like a face covering, like a cloth mask or these masks that are being handmade by people, or even regular surgical masks are not necessarily very protective in terms of keeping you from getting the virus. The N95 masks, the high quality medical masks, those are the ones that are used in the medical setting and should be able to prevent almost all exposures to the virus. So I don't want to go on and take too much time. I know you have a lot of other guests, but I hope that might be helpful information. The risk of universal masking is that people may have a false sense of security and think that they're protected. And the main thing is we want to not make people think that they're protected if they wear a mask. You should still keep a distance of at least 6 feet, maybe greater if you can. Definitely all of the other guidance regarding hand washing, use alcohol-based hand sanitizer when you're away from home, should be at least 60% alcohol content, and then hand washing with soap and water, aggressive, you know, at least 20 seconds of hand washing with soap and water at home is all that you need. You don't need to use hand sanitizer and alcohol in the home.
Well, thank you so much.
That's
for
nice
Mary Adams of Rochester, New York. Mother of active political family, including her husband, Ricardo Adams, and her daughter, Sarah Adams. They're causing a great stir and important struggle up in Rochester, and you will hear more about the Adams family. Thank you, Sister Betty.
Okay, we're going to move right along. I hope I'm opening the correct microphone for one of our guests. The last four digits are 0745. Is this Brother Zaid?
Yes, it is. Yes, it is.
Oh, I got it right. All right. Brother Zaid Muhammad is a human rights activist and poet and an advocate for political prisoners. We cannot say how many times we've seen him host a political prisoner fundraiser and support our dear sister Lynn. Brother Zaid, thank you so much for joining us. And the other guests, if we have to, we will extend the time. Brother Zaid, your mic is open.
Wow. Wow. Where do we begin? Oh, my goodness. Oh. This thing
you
is
begin
a mess.
Where you
Oh, this thing is a mess. First, let me just thank you all for what you're doing. Y'all have a loaded show. I didn't even realize that you had a show. Right? You would have been made press contacts. And I've been getting you stuff more regular for what for all the stuff that I do, for all the different forces that I do press work for. But I'm glad you're doing what you're doing, and I'm glad, of course, as always, that we have so very few outlets that are very serious about the whole question of the release of our political prisoners, and that you're making yourselves available to do that. And, of course, you know, y'all have been out here for longer than I have, you know. I mean, yeah, I've been out here for over 40 years, and, you know, y'all have been through the battle days, of, you know, we had a real movement once upon a time long ago, and
yes,
y'all
are
still out. I just want to, you know, first thank you for that. And give you your props on that. Where do we go from here? Where do we begin? I think the most basic thing, and I'm sure you probably have covered it already, is that this pandemic is putting real pressures on this country's prison system, and as a consequence, this thing is destined to mushroom and fester and spread like crazy in America's prison. And we even have, well, we have these false-faced liberal governors who are getting all this wonderful media that they couldn't pay for, including the one I got in New Jersey who's part of the 1%. He's a 1% liberal, Phil Murphy. Couldn't pay for this kind of free press that they're getting. But when it comes time for them to actually do something that they have in their hand that they can do, and that wouldn't cost the state a hell of a lot of money, is to release some people to take some pressure off of the system. And so, you know, in New York has a very strong release aging prisoners program, RAP, very strong. I had a strong press conference / action in spite of this pandemic that got very serious critical attention a few weeks ago, because Governor Cuomo, for all of his passionate concerns about trying to save as many lives as he can, has at his disposal the means to release, you know, a lot of folks who no longer belong in the prison system. We're talking about aging prisoners. We're talking about prisoners who are medically vulnerable. We talk about prisoners who've done the kind of time and have already demonstrated that they're no threat to society and are due to be released on parole anyway. And in that mix, of course, is our political prisoners, right? And so many of them, not only do they fit the general category of you know, being released in the interest of taking pressure off the system, but they are at risk. Many of them have their own very serious ailments as we speak. We just got word yesterday that the High Court is not going to hear the appeal of Imam Jamil El-Amin. Imam Jamil just recovered from a stroke last year, right? On top of having been fighting multiple myeloma for the last several years, right? The state of Pennsylvania, Mumia Abu-Jamal is survived almost everything, and he is still very much in a precarious situation just by virtue of what his health has been through with his battle with Hep C recently and the other things that have come as a consequence of that. You know, and we can go on down the line. Ed Poindexter out in Nebraska, all this evidence, you know that's coming out in the on his case and what happened to him and his co-defendant, right, who we already lost in prison, right? And Ed had a major operation last year, right, at risk. Maroon Schultz, battling with cancer, stage 4 colon cancer, right? All of these, Sundiata, his business facility, as I understand, is on lockdown, and I was hoping Valerie Haynes would be on because I understand that she has some more information because she may have been one of the last persons to have heard from Sundiata. 83 years old, had an operation himself just a couple of years ago, right? Has been cleared for parole by a federal judge almost 20 years ago, and they still won't let him go. Veronica Bowers is a cancer survivor. I mean, you know, we can go, I mean, who doesn't out of our political prisoners are at risk for contracting this illness and losing them as a consequence of it? What I'm hearing, one of the things I will say that what I'm hearing, and that seems to be a common thread in most of these prisons, even though this illness is what's the term I'm looking for? A disease that has no borders, that is affecting prison guards, prison healthcare workers, prison food medics, as much as it's affecting prisoners, right? There's still, you know, very few of the precautions that are properly being taken to address this kind of thing. And how can you do that in prison anyway? You have a whole national infrastructure that's called prison that's built on slamming people together in order to get them to do almost free labor for the benefit of the state and the corporations that benefit the state. The whole it's a sham, the whole concept of social distancing in the prison. So, I mean, so it's there. It's, you know, so all those, that's what I'm, where I'm going with all this, so all those within the earshot of this call should be supporting calls in your respective state to put pressure on these jive governors, no matter how liberal they claim to be, to release our aging prisoners, to release all those, you know, vulnerable in the prison population from prison, to take some prison, some pressure off of these systems, and to give folks a chance to live, right? And give folks a chance to live on all, and quite frankly, live on all sides, because folks are going down on all sides. Right? So I guess that's where I just wanted to jump in at. And I hope Valerie is on the line. I think I know she has a lot to add.
Well, thank you so much for that. Thank you for reminding us of prison as slave camp and now prisons as death camps. Thank you again. Look forward to hearing more from you, Sister Betty.
Again, Brother Saeed Muhammad, the human rights advocate, poet, and political prisoner advocate, our mic is always open to you. You have an open invitation, and we thank you for this. I do believe Sister Valerie is on because we do see a long list of names. At this point, we're going to go to Brother Tom. He came across an interesting article with some horrific statistics, and we asked him if he would be able to find that article, which we tried to resend to him, and enlighten us with it. Brother Tom Syracuse, your mic is open.
Thank you very much. I had sent a report from Milwaukee to both Sister Davis and Brother Ralph showing that African Americans have contracted and died of the coronavirus at an alarming rate. So I'd like to read you this report, plus I added some things that have happened here in New York State. As the disease, this is the report from Milwaukee. As the disease spread at a higher rate in the black community, it made an even deeper cut. Environmental, economic, and political factors have compounded for generations, putting black people at higher risk of chronic conditions that leave lungs weak and immune systems vulnerable. Asthma, heart disease, hypertension, diabetes. In Milwaukee, simply being black means your life expectancy is 14 years shorter on average than someone white. As of Friday morning, African Americans made up almost half of Milwaukee's 945 cases and 81% of its 27 deaths in a city whose population is 26% black. Milwaukee is one of the few places in the United States that is tracking the racial breakdown of people who have been affected by the virus, offering a glimpse at the disproportionate destruction it is inflicting on black communities nationwide. Although New York State does not have racial data of the rate of coronavirus infections or death, there are maps available on the internet showing the greatest incidence of the virus in the boroughs of New York City. And these maps show that those communities of color, both African American and Latino, have the highest infection rates. Just recently, the New York State Legislature following the urging of Governor Cuomo, passed a budget for New York State for this year, and it includes a reduction of the state's funding for Medicaid, and this will especially affect communities of color. Also, the legislature passed a law which makes it impossible for third parties to exist in New York State. Previously, all parties had to receive at least 50,000 votes for their gubernatorial and presidential candidates to get on the ballot. Both the Green and the Libertarian parties were able to achieve that threshold in the last election. No easy task. The new law raises the threshold from 50,000 to 150,000 votes. No problem for the Democrats and Republicans, which have the personnel and money to get the required number of signatures on their petitions. New York State now has the most stringent requirement for third parties to get on the ballot in the entire nation. And this further ensures that the two-party monopoly of the Democrats and Republicans will have no competition in the political process in New York State. And that the public, this denies the public from getting alternative points of views on issues. None of these measures have been reported on the mass media.
Well, thank you so much.
So there you go with Governor Cuomo and the Democratic-controlled legislature on not only taking it out, austerity measures, taking it out on the people that can least endure this, but also eliminating any criticism of them from third parties.
Well, thank you so much for that, Tom. And we must spend an entire program on this issue and the ramifications at a later date. But thank you for your report. And Sister Betty, who's next?
We're moving right along. We want to open up another one of the allies of political prisoners and a strong supporter of Mamia Abu-Jamal and a tireless fighter for Sister Lynn and, of course, an advocate for Public Free Radio. Brother Henry Higgins, thank you for getting on board. Please, your mic is open.
Well, thanks for the invitation, and it's an honor and pleasure. I caught a news story this morning from Chicago where Sister Lori Lightfoot, the new mayor, has determined that the data coming in based on this COVID virus has a disproportionate number of African Americans and Latinos suffering from the disease itself in relationship to the rest of the population. And she's now trying to institute a program that will outreach to those persons of color 50 years and up to alert them to make improvements on their health conditions and certainly to exercise extreme caution when traveling about to avoid the COVID virus. And she determined that also there's a predisposition with ailments such as diabetes, high blood pressure, etc. And it makes people of color more vulnerable because in comparison to other ethnic groups, they are at greater risk. And I think it's important for us to continue to make the effort to remain safe and also to educate ourselves further about what's being done to, in my opinion, to not really alleviate the problem with the present administration in power, because he just seems to relish in trying to use this opportunity to become reelected or advance his reelection campaign. And it's a very important development, because if he succeeds in winning reelection, it spells more trouble for us. Also, in general, when it comes to what the Cubans are able to do and internally in their country and overseas, is remarkable and worthy of high praise. Cubans have a history of being internationalists and using their resources and their personnel to help distress countries and territories to remain solvent and lift themselves out of the grips of this colonialism that puts them at risk. And we must also be aware of the fact that the threats against Venezuela are increasing, and we need to offer tremendous support for Venezuela, because after all, Venezuela is among those countries that remain under the threat from U.S. imperialism. There's now an attempt being made to overthrow the government of Venezuela under Maduro, and the president himself is spreading a lot of lies as usual, but they're trying to ante up the support for an attack against Venezuela, and Venezuela needs our support as well. Here's another piece by Dr. Zeke Emanuel. He says the virus is real, and he sees the problem continuing for the next year and a half. And he says that in the face of the idea that there are 60 million workers still working, but many people are out of work, and this is going to create further hardships on people who are not rich and what could be called the spoiled children of imperialism. And as the brother pointed out earlier, our political prisoners remain under threats through the disease in the prison systems, and we must continue to support our political prisoners. In this society, they deny that political prisoners exist, and of course we know that that's not true. There are political prisoners. And as a result, they're being punished for their political positions that challenge the status quo. And,
well, thank you so much. Oh, I just thought you were finished.
Yeah, I'm going to leave it right there. I've been away from the phones for a while, and so I'm a little rusty. So I apologize for the interruptions. So thank you.
Well, you're never away from our hearts. We remember you for so much that you have done, the work that you have done in the pursuit of liberation for all of the people on the planet. Thank you, Brother Henry Higgins.
Sister, thank you, Ralph, and Sister Betty as well.
Okay, again, to those of you who called in, we've extended the time to 10:30 this evening because we want to get everyone in, and we're going to immediately segue to Sister Ann Lamb, who is our resident advocate for political prisoners, and she has all the latest updates. And what I like about Sister Ann's presentation is that she covers all the aspects of the prison in the context within the struggle for political prisoners. Sister Ann, your mic is open.
Thank you so much, Sister Betty.
Sister Mary just texted me that apparently Trump had the nerve to question why the statistics of COVID-19 genocide are impacting on black people so much. And Mary, your mic is open. Is that what you said? Sister Mary?
Yeah, I caught part of his speech today, and he brought it up. He brought up the disproportionality, and then he said, we need to find out why. It's a mystery, you know, why disproportionality and racism exist. And so it's kind of scary to have him wanting to inquire.
Yeah,
he wants to know how to be more effective. Okay, Sister Ann, your mic is open. Please continue.
Okay, thank you so much, Sister Betty, Brother Ralph, everybody else. It was great to hear from Saeed before because he said a lot of the things I was going to say. But I've been tracking and trying to track, you know, what the hell is going on inside our prisons, which, as we all know, are death camps anyway. In the Federal Bureau of Prisons reports, as of today, that there are 241 federal inmates and 73 BOP staff who have actually tested positive for COVID-19. So that means that there are probably many more because they're only testing people when they're really, really sick. Not the staff, perhaps, but certainly the inmates. 8 federal inmates have died from COVID-19 so far, right? And they go ahead to go and list them. You can go up to their website, bop.gov/corona, and they're going to put this out every day. They list it by facility, how many inmates positive, how many staff positive, et cetera. And it's very interesting to note that some of the highest ones, Butner Medium 1, FCI in Butner, North Carolina, 40 inmates positive. Oakdale 1, FCI in Oakdale, Louisiana, 38 inmates positive. Lompoc, USP in California, 29. Danbury, FCI, 28, right? And Yazoo City Low, FCI, has 18. And then, you know, the numbers continue down as, you know, they go. But they list every single prison. And they're putting this out daily. Now, we know that, you know, it's not necessarily accurate, but at least it's there. And, you know, because they're not really testing all people. And there's also a whole bunch of stuff about state. I finally found some stuff about state prisoners. Now, interesting to know that the first person to die of COVID-19, who was a city jail inmate, he died in Bellevue Hospital on Sunday. You know what he was in prison for? He was in prison because he had a parole violation. That's what he was in prison for. So he was given the death sentence because he had a minor parole violation. And his name is Michael Tyson, and he was 53 years old. All right? And he'd been in city custody since February 28th. And he actually died at Bellevue Hospital because he was that sick that they took him to Bellevue Hospital. And he was among the 100 detainees that, from the Bronx that the Legal Aid Society had been seeking immediate release for. So Tina Luongo, who I know personally, she's the attorney in charge of the criminal defense practice at Legal Aid. She says, "We are both heartbroken and outraged to learn that our client, who was held on Rikers Island for a technical parole violation, has passed away from COVID-19. Right? So this is, you know, serious stuff. So I would say on March 27th, Governor Andrew Cuomo, the worm, announced that the State Department of Corrections and Community Supervision would begin to release low-level technical parole violators from local jails, including up to 400 in New York City. This is taking a long time because each case is reviewed by, guess who, prosecutors and state prison officials. All right? So this poor guy got the death sentence for a parole violation, all right? Now, according to what they're saying about the New York City Correction Department, there are 273 detainees. These are detainees. These people have not been convicted of any crime. 273 detainees have tested positive for coronavirus as of Sunday, right? 321 correction personnel and 53 jail health staffers. Right, and meanwhile, about 2,500 of the department's uniformed officers and 200 civilians are out sick. So last month, Ross McDonald, who's the jail system's top doctor, took to Twitter to warn that a storm is coming and begged city officials to release as many vulnerable inmates as possible. A storm is coming, and I know what I'll be doing when it claims my first patient. What will you be doing? What will you have done? We have told you who is at risk. Please let as many out as you possibly can. So, you know, you see that this ignoring of prisoners is really creating a huge crisis. And then one more thing from an upstate radio. COVID-19 numbers in the New York State prison and parole system continue to rise, you know, and they were reporting as of this morning, 319 of the department's approximately 29,000 employees have confirmed cases of COVID-19. This is state. 55 of the department's approximately 43,000 incarcerated individuals, as well as 15 of the more than 35,000 parolees under supervision, also have confirmed cases. So these are just people who have been tested. In the New York State Department of Corrections, they report 5 COVID-19-related deaths, a civilian employee, 2 incarcerated individuals, and 2 parolees. So that's where we stand so far. I'm sure the numbers are really much higher. And as we know, RAP and others, we've been working together to try to get, you know, as many people possible released. They're doing very effective work on that. They're having some kind of Zoom conference tomorrow, actually, at 7 p.m. our time, which I will be participating in. It's a joint effort between New York State and people in California who are facing a lot of the same, you know, difficulties in trying to get their people out. So I'm finished.
Well,
that's all I have to say. What's the call? Free them all. This is the time to open the prison gates and let everybody come out of those death camps and come home.
Well, thank you so much for that, Anna, of New York, Jerick. And that tells you something. It tells you, one, either the ineptness of the prison system or the willingness or the desire to let the prisoners die. That's why we call them camps.
Okay, before we go on, I'm opening up the mics. If we hear a lot of background noise, we will mute the mics again, but if anybody wants to comment on any of the presentations so far, please feel free. That includes what's already presented. And then I think we're going to be able to go to the last four digits of 5039. 5039, we're going to go to you after we have the general comments. Could you identify, please?
Yes. How are you doing this, Dave? This is Dr. Zena Crenshaw-Lobo out of Atlanta.
Okay. Did you want to make comments in terms of Atlanta this evening with us?
No, I'm just listening in. I was hoping that Ms. Melinda would be online and we'd talk a bit about what's happening in Louisiana. But I'm listening and enjoy getting all this information.
Well, I have texted her. She said she was definitely going to call in. We will mute your mic then. The rest of you, your presentations are, if you've got presentations that are forthcoming, please know we've extended the time. However, anyone who wants to comment on Sister Mary, Sister Ann, Brother Zaid, or Brother Higgins, your mics are open.
Or Brother Tom.
I'm so sorry. Anybody else want to make any further comments?
I thought that Tom's presentation was very important. You know, we're talking about a country that has been founded on genocide, racism, and violence. So the fact that this virus would attack people of color more than, you know, other folk is not surprising when you consider the racism in the medical system, the racism in society. You know, the fact that black people have more diseases, which leads them to be more susceptible to this virus because they don't get the same health care as white people get. And, you know, that's really important, and I was really glad that he brought that up because I've been posting on Facebook and email various articles and commentaries about the same issue, and it's going on throughout the country, and it is extremely, extremely important.
Well, as Mary Adams from Rochester says, she just saw something on television that said, Mr. Trump is going to have to find out why this is happening. And I would like to answer Mr. Trump by saying, we know why it's happening. Just listening on our program will give it to you, book in case. Sister Betty.
Well, Sister Mary has a question. Mary, would you say that on the air, please? Sister Ann, you need to listen. It's directed at you. Go ahead, Mary.
So I wanted to know if there's any kind of, like, clearinghouse or someone collecting reports from individual prisons of people who are ill, because we know that they're not going to do adequate testing, and we know that, you know, unless the health department actually gets tests, it's not going to be reported. I mean, you described very well the Bureau of Prisons, the federal system, having a reporting mechanism, but we know that things are going to happen in individual prisons without reporting, without testing. So how will families find out, and how, like, is there a way that they can, that there's a clearinghouse of some kind? Could you serve as that?
Well, I've sort of been doing that, but I will definitely touch base with other individuals and groups who are working on the same issue and see, because it's an overwhelming job, and see if anybody is actually doing that. Because as I said about the BOP, you know, that's only the people they've tested, and they only test people when they're mad sick. You know, they're not testing prisoners when it comes to the prisoners. You know, so a lot of people probably have it who are not being tested. I was reading some horrible testimonies from women prisoners in New Jersey. This woman definitely had COVID. She had all the symptoms. They didn't give her any treatment at all, and they stuck her in what the equivalent of the hole. And she was in the hole for, like, you know, various days, because she was supposedly being, you know, quarantined. And she was in a cell that had only hot running water, didn't have any cold water, didn't have any medical attention, you know, and she was self-reporting to somebody, because it got reported, you know, in a news article. But we need to really have a clearinghouse, like you say, for this. And I will definitely ask around and see if maybe, you know, the ACLU or CCR or any of these other folk are actually doing this. And if people are, then we can at least combine our efforts, you know, and come up with one, you know, sort of clearinghouse, and then let people know about it. I'll check it out during the week, definitely, and hopefully by next week I will have a clear answer for you.
Thank you, Sister Ann, and thank you, Mary Adams. We're going to go at this point to Brother Joel. And Brother Joel, your mic is open. Brother Joel, your mic is open. Hello, Joel. Take it off mute, please.
Yes,
we hear you. Go right ahead.
Yes, so I think, again, the government accomplishes something with this pandemic that they foisted on us, on all of us. And what that does is it gives many people the appearance that the government is a benevolent organization, that it's here to help us, much as like a school kid, you know, in second or third grade, gets told how the police officer who's directing traffic near the school is your best friend. And that's what people are being induced to feel as they driven by fear and mystery and puzzlement, because all of a sudden this thing popped out of nowhere, or popped out of the bio warfare labs, came upon us totally unexpectedly. Even though similar things have been done before, but this is the first time that it's a world pandemic, that it's international, goes around the world, and is actually a global pandemic. And I want to say, you know, like we're talking about the way that it's especially prevalent now in the prisons, that prisoners are having their prison sentences being converted, possibly a death sentence, or at least a sentence where their entire health is extremely threatened, when prisons are at high risk. It should be remembered that in regimes like Nazi Germany, for example, a lot of the deaths that took place in the death camps there were induced by diseases. For example, typhus was a very prevalent condition and accounted for many, many of the lives that were lost in the concentration camps. And we know that the that's a very similar thing to what's going on in the death camps here. Although I don't think the Nazis invented typhus the way that the American counterinsurgent infrastructure and biological warfare infrastructure invented the diseases that are inflicted on targeted populations today. And this one, remember, it's around the world. And people, you know, one of the things that we truly spoke a number of times during a few years ago when it became a prevalent topic, but that the diseases that were going around then also, and the way the medical establishment is structured, were largely designed to cull the population of retired persons, disabled persons, that is, people that are not part of a profit-making, exploited workforce, and are therefore considered a burden upon the economy because they're, well, what the Nazis used to say was useless eaters, meaning people that were consuming things but not being exploited as part of a workforce in the community. And so a lot of this disease is designed to be fatal in more circumstances, or severely disabling in terms of a form of pneumonia, viral pneumonia, that this virus turns into, which tends to destroy the lives and end the lives early of that portion of the population, while the younger and more vigorous types, even if they become infected, largely get mild or even asymptomatic cases where they don't even know that they have it, but it's still and they can be spread it without even knowing it. And it's a very complicated thing. And I want to say that we're being accustomed more and more now to this whole lockdown situation. Now, we don't know when that's going to lift. I know a lot of times when the police take over an area for some public event and they have certain restrictions and they have large police presence, but after the event is over that they were policing, if you go back to that scene, if it was a major intervention, you know, a few hours later and they're still stopping the traffic, they're still maintaining a state of emergency. And that's another thing that we don't know when this disease is going to attenuate at all. In fact, Anthony Fauci, who's been one of the leading biological warfare spokespeople over the years, became more well known, explaining away the AIDS epidemic, another suddenly emerging disease that attacked mainly targeted populations. That Anthony Fauci is saying that this disease now is not just going to go away. Some people thought that in the summer there would be like the end of its season, but he said that it's rapidly spreading now in many tropical countries, and that shows that it's going to be around as at least a cyclical disease presence for some time, unless until a vaccine comes about. And I don't know if people, under the kind of pressure that they are, being forced to take a certain vaccine on a world scale, we don't really know what all the effects of such a vaccine are going to be. The price of becoming immune to coronavirus, maybe some other things like the vaccine will do. People are going to be under a lot of pressure. Like, people have been told that unless they can sponsorize it to get this vaccine, they can't go to a major event. You can't organize major demonstrations. Like, that's too many people too close together. And what you're really worried about is the energy and the ideas that people who are politically active, who are out on the streets demonstrating, who are forming organizations to accomplish ends, to resist oppression, and to build a revolutionary momentum, that this will shut a lot of that down. And also, it changes not only like the gathering in groups as a physical presence, but also changes the mentality that people become afraid of each other, have to keep a certain distance, and so on. Right now, they're saying that you can't have a gathering of more than 10 people, meaning like not only a major demonstration, but even the steering committee that organizes it generally would be larger than 10. So now, in a lot of the classical fascist countries, like Mussolini's Italy or Nazi Germany, it was routine that nobody is supposed to be on the streets after dark. There's a curfew. And when I stop to think, a lot of this whole thing, which is directed against street life in general, because street life leads to the situation where people get together in an autonomous and unsupervised way. And I stop to think that may have been the first blow in that may have been the imposition of the curfew on Tompkins Square Park. Because everyone knows that at that time, the streets were very crowded around Tompkins Square Park. There were all kinds of activities going on. It was in the Lower East Side, which was a very creative neighborhood, which put forth a lot of the artists and writers and musicians. And so on. Also, it was an area where people were in struggle against the state, and where there was a great deal of bridging of the gaps between different ethnic groups and different races. So people were unifying on a potentially revolutionary basis, but largely in this whole area. And there was another area in Berkeley called the People's Park, which also has now been curfewed. And if you remember, the curfewing of Tompkins Square Park produced a gigantic number of rebellions and physical fighting back against the police that were imposing the curfew, which had not been seen in a long time in Western countries. And it was even one of the movements that you could say had been able to seize territory to a certain degree, because it involved a lot of people living in abandoned buildings and the creation of a squatters movement, which was the people seizing the territory and creating a zone of resistance in the Lower East Side. And that may have been symptomatic of what could develop on a nationwide scale as revolutionary consciousness grew and fed upon itself. And this seems to be a continuation of the same thing, because even before this pandemic was foisted upon us, I flew a year and a half or 2 years before. It was a very significant, although gradual, closing of all the businesses that used to be open in the Lower East Side, which was largely a 24-hour neighborhood. For those who wanted it to be, a lot of people, of course, kept regular hours, but it was a place where you had the option to go out in the streets, and there were always crowds of people to socialize with and be active with, and there were a lot of businesses like restaurants and musical places and bars. So the whole area was alive. And by about 2 years ago, through some pressure in the background, not through some kind of epidemic or people being
Mike is not
the businesses began closing at 10 o'clock or 8 o'clock, and the crowds disappeared so that the streets were largely empty after 8 o'clock at night. And this was before the pandemic broke out. And I feel that the lockdown combined with the curtailment of street life and forcing of people to be like in a prison in their cells, but in their apartments. You couldn't, and in some cities now, you could be fined for being on the sidewalk without an excuse. And I heard that there was a $500 fine. I don't know if this has been enforced, but declared and raised now to $1,000 for coming within 6 feet of another person in a public space. So we're features of a major dictatorship, and we know that this was not just brought about through the disease itself and to the damage that it does, but also to get people used to accepting the conditions of constant lockdown and also to sort of ignore their own victimization by having biological warfare directed against everyone as a population with significant numbers of people's health is being permanently destroyed or whose lives are being ended by the effects of this particular disease as designed. This is by design. It is not.
We're going to have to cut you off there. You have done a great job, and we're going to have to continue along those lines. And for those who are interested in your earlier part of your presentation, Larry Romanoff did a presentation on guns and butter. His book is Humanity at the Crossroads, and it's COVID USA Global Research Dossier, and you could go into book and case on that. Great detail on the origins of this disease. Thank you again, Joel, and Sister Betty.
We're going to open up Brother Paul Gilman's mic, and I believe we have Sister Belinda waiting in the background for us. But we're so glad that Brother Gilman called in. And Joel is correct. They did increase the fines for being in the public without a valid reason from $500 to $1,000. Those of you who have read Albert Camus' The Plague knows the parallels between an epidemic and fascism and the total control of your life. Brother Paul, your mic is open, and Sister Belinda, if you're in the wings, we're definitely going to be calling on you next.
Hello, everybody. Hi, Sister Betty. Hi, Brother Ralph.
How you doing?
Hello?
And I'd like to begin this conversation, not cutting into you, about illicit drugs in America, the joke and the lie. And we first must understand that most European countries that needed money went to drugs to get it. And a major example of that is when Britain needed money, they insisted on introducing heroin to China. This was the Opium Wars. They forced this drug into China, and they made money. And let us remember, as I opened the program with the United States threatening Panama for washing drug money, and it caused pandemonium in the banking systems of America and Panama. And the government of Bush had to remind them, oh, not you, it's those other guys. Continue, Paul. Tell us where your words of wisdom for this evening.
Well, last week's show was really intense, as is this one, because the COVID virus is affecting everything. And right now, the big thing I've been seeing as far as cannabis goes is that, you know, in New Jersey, where they have legal cannabis and they have all of these dispensaries you could go to, they're all shutting down. And the people who rely on cannabis to treat their very serious illnesses, especially like epilepsy and stuff, have now been cut off from legal cannabis. And this underscores the need that any cannabis bills we have must include provisions to grow your own, in other words, home grow. And so this takes us to what is seeming to be the darling of everybody, Governor Cuomo. And I wanted to ask you this last week is, you know, he's against cannabis, but, you know, the politics of New York forces him to do it. So he makes these bills with all these poison pills, and the biggest poison pill in it, or two of them, are one, no home grow, two, not making serious provisions to make up for, you know, the inequities of the drug war on the Black and Latino community. And I guess the third one is outrageous taxation schemes. So, Ralph, I'd like to pose this question to you. When presented with a – yeah?
Go ahead. I'm listening.
Okay. When presented with a terrible bill that sounds good on the surface, how do we handle this? A bill with all kinds of poison pills. Do we support it? Do we not support it? Or do we ignore it and just keep on doing what we're already doing?
Well, I think we have to keep on doing what we're already doing. We can't ignore it because there's two types of drugs in, as I used to say, in the prisons, the legal drugs in the prisons and the illegal drugs in the prisons. And while I was in prison, it was obvious that the legal drugs were the ones that were the best. That was the drugs brought in by the CEOs and the correction officers. And now we have the same thing on the street. We have legal drugs, that is the drug supported by the corporations, that is the opioid epidemic that we have, and the illegal drugs. And we have to recognize that they have made them illegal, but we have to recognize the immorality of the law. The law is picking and choosing to give the same people an advantage who always had the advantage and the disadvantage to the people who don't or are not a part
right.
of the ruling class. And so we have to remember them, not ignore them. We have to know that they are illegal, but we have to defend ourselves by growing your own.
We want to thank
you,
Brother Paul. We really appreciate you calling in. Thank you
thank
so
you.
Much. Okay. We're going to go to Sister Gwen, and then we're going to leave with Louisiana. It is very important that you hear the latest which is coming out of Louisiana. Sister Gwen, can you give us a few words of wisdom before we go to Sister Belinda Parker Brown?
Yeah, I guess so. Either that or I'm going to have to give you a bedtime story. I just want to say that I've been thinking a lot about the virus like everybody else has this week. I heard a very interesting show that I sent off to Ralph and Betty on Guns and Butter that I would encourage everybody to listen to in regards to this the origins of this. And, you know, I think I've said this before, that I wondered when this came out. It just seemed very strange to me that this virus first hit the nations that we declared in our axis of evil. So the first one it hit was China. And then the second one was off to Iran. And I wondered in my head, well, how does this virus like go from China to Iran? Like, and then it went to Korea and then off to Italy. And, it just seems strange to me that the places it was hitting, because it seemed strategic to me and seemed a lot like what happened on 9/11. All these, you know, there was apparently some kind of an exercise, a war game kind of thing that happened before this pandemic happened, very, very close to when it started. And then it happened. And it also seems, you know, I turned on the TV and I keep hearing how it's affecting the Black population. And it's very strange to me how it's hitting, you know, the Black population much harder than it is the white population. And just the whole thing seems to be very strategic and very strange. I go up every day to the park because I want to walk by Mount Sinai and I want to see what's going on over there. And I want to, at first when I started walking by, I would walk by and I, you know, I kept calling Joel and saying, I don't see anybody in the hospital. And I thought, this is really weird. It's just very, very quiet up here. I don't see anybody in here. I don't see anybody in the waiting room. I don't see anything. I walked by on a Saturday and it was really quiet at the hospital. And I went up to a security guard and said, I want blood. And he said, well, you can't do it here because today we're doing tests. I said, you're doing tests? I said, there's not one person here. He said, well, go around to the other side. And I thought, you know, every time you've seen a testing site, you've seen it packed with people. So I went to the front of the hospital and I walked in. I was kind of surprised I was able to walk in. And I asked about giving blood and I didn't see anybody in there that was there to have a test taken. So there's just a lot of strange things. I've been asking a lot of doctors when I see them and nurses when they're walking by, and I do ask them about, you know, what's going on inside, and, you know, they do tell me it's very busy, but it's a strange time. I mean, people seem very relaxed. You know, when you go to the park, you wouldn't even know that there was a pandemic going on because families seem to be happy to be together. There's, I don't know, there just seems to be an overall relaxed sense. I don't really see people super uptight. This guy, Billy Graham, or Franklin Graham, has his circus show in the middle of Central Park with all these tents. I sat there an hour and a half the other day to see who was being put into those tents, but nobody was put into those tents. It's just the strangest thing. I mean, now, when I did look at, I did stand in front of the hospital 2 days ago where the ambulances come in. I do have to say, I did see ambulances kept coming in. Well, at least I counted three while I was there, three, like, back to back, one, two, three. So there were people, but even when the ambulance drivers would get out, they didn't seem to be moving with any kind of speed. You know, they were very kind of lethargic about getting the person out and getting them in, and it just seems to be, I don't know, very, very strange. The whole thing is strange. Is it happening? Yes, it's happening. It's really dangerous because, you know, you can die really, really quickly from it. So you've got to stay on your toes. But I just think that this pandemic has raised a lot of questions in my own mind, some that I won't say out loud because I don't want to be called crazy. But, you know, I think it's crazy to ignore these things. I think one of the biggest problems we had was we decided collectively to not examine 9/11. And when you didn't examine 9/11, when you didn't take it seriously, when we didn't even try to bring that to the forefront, they decided to go to the next step. And now we have this gigantic pandemic, which is going to decimate the economy of almost every nation in the world, and definitely ours. And it just seems to be that there's whoever is behind this, and I'm sorry, I do think there's somebody behind this. Don't seem to, you know, keep going.
Could I cut you off right there and ask you if you can give us the date of that program on WBAI? It is archived by Bonnie Faulkner, Guns and Butter, with Larry Romanoff going into great details about the origins of this pandemic. And I think it is very important that everyone pay attention to that. Do you have that at your hand?
Yeah, it was last Tuesday, and so it was the first. I'm sorry, it was March the 31st, and it was Bonnie Faulkner.
March 31st.
March 31st.
Guns and Butter.
Look,
anybody can go look it up on, and it was amazing to listen to. But she had a show with another fellow who also talked about the origins of this not being natural, and he talked about it also being germ warfare, but he went into it from a different angle, same kind of origin, but different aspects of it. And I would tell people to listen to both of it. I mean, these are really
we're
going to
have
incredible interviews.
Yes, you've given him March 31st, Bonnie Faulkner, Guns and Butter, and
it's archived.
Archived.
So without further ado, we're going to have to go to Sister Belinda because we have been waiting for her update. Sister Belinda, your mic is open, Louisiana United International.
Wow. Thank you, Sister Betty and Brother Ralph. I want to let you guys know how much I really appreciate you. I am so very grateful for this opportunity to at least let you know how hectic and how bad it really is here in the state of Louisiana. You know, I've been dealing with some personal situations with my family in regards to this deadly COVID-19 virus. And I want the people to know that are listening that this is serious. You know, if you're not familiar with Louisiana, everybody should know about the Mardi Gras. They knew about this way before the Mardi Gras. And the Zulu flow is the one that is most popular here in Louisiana. And I want people to know that 19 of those people that were on the Zulu flow went to the hospital. 5 of them are dead already, okay? So when the young ladies say that this stuff is, you die fast, I mean, you die quick and fast. But the most horrific thing that's happening here in Louisiana is the fact that the virus is spreading like a wildfire in the prison of Angola. In that prison, we have over 7,000 inmates. And what they're doing is that they're bringing more inmates in from other facilities around the state, and they're saying that they're going to make that incubator for to quarantine the virus. But I'm here to tell the whole world that I believe that it's a death trap. It's a death trap for so many people that are being held hostage and kidnapped inside of this most horrific prison, which is the Louisiana State Penitentiary, none other than Angola, that was known as the bloodiest and the worst prison in the whole world. So this is what's happening here in Louisiana. And not only that, I want the people to know that the governor have ordered that they start releasing people that are being held on nonviolent offenders and people that have violated their parole and that they have chronic illnesses to be released. And this is the worst. You know, we think Katrina was bad. I want the people to know, and you talked about 9/11. You think all of those things was bad, but I'm here to tell you what's getting ready to happen here in Louisiana is going to be worse because of the fact that they're saying in the jails that they're not going to release the people, okay? I know for a fact that they're not testing them. We don't have any data information on the local parish jail that I live in, this parish, St. Tammany, that the young man, one of the inmates have been calling out, crying, and saying that, you know, he's feverish, he's in pain, you know, he's coughing, he has asthma, he has hypertension, he's a diabetic, and they said that they would not test him for the COVID virus because of the fact that his fever was not high enough. So with all of this going on here in Louisiana, we're asking people to just call our governor, you know, let the governor know, let the legislators and all of our state representatives know that there is a major, major disparity when it comes to black people that are going to die from this coronavirus, the COVID-19 that is deadly, and people have to speak up and speak out and let their voices be heard that black people are being treated, you know, kicked to the side. And you know, we just had a family. First it was the mom that went to the hospital, then the husband that took the mom to the hospital, you know, came back home. Okay, she died in the hospital. He came back home. He's dead, and all the three siblings are dead. So this is what's happening, people. This is sad. This is. I can't even find the words to describe, you know, how serious this is, especially when it comes to how black people are being treated here in Louisiana. Thank
is
you
this
for
information
allowing me to share.
Louisiana United International, Belinda Parker Brown. Everybody remember that. Belinda Parker Brown, Louisiana United.
And you can
get
to my website at www.launitedi.org. Thank you.
Thank you so much. And all of you, come back next week. We have more information, more wonderful speakers. And our program, the theme of our program over and over again is education, education, education. And with education, we will win. Good night, my brothers and sisters.
I wish I could say all the things that I should say.